Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Syrian government forces pounded rebel-held positions near Damascus today in the latest fighting in the nearly five-year-long civil war. That war has intensified recently, even as the international community pushes to restart peace talks between the government of President Bashar al-Assad and the opposition. Those talks are supposed to resume in New York later this month. Inside Syria, the toll from the conflict has been devastating. More than 250,000 people have been killed and more than 6 million have been displaced but remain inside Syria. And then, of course, there are the millions more who have left the country. The United Nations said today that 72% of the Syrian population has no access to drinking water. Our next guest has seen the damage for herself. Lise Doucette is the BBC's chief international correspondent. She was just in Syria for 10 days. She joins us now from Beirut, Lebanon. Lise, welcome back to Here and Now.
Well, it's good to be back with you.
Well, where were you able to go in Syria and what did you see?
Well, we visited Damascus, of course, the capital. We were on an official visa. And then while we were there, there was a significant development in the city of Homs, a local ceasefire in the last district under rebel-held control, which means that the city, which used to be known among activists and the opposition as the capital of the revolution, is now back completely under the control of the government. So it was an important symbolism for the government, a bitter moment for the opposition, but a sign of where Syria is heading nearly 5 years since the uprising against President Assad's rule began. Damascus, of course, is one of the relatively peaceful parts of Syria, but you're reminded that there's not a corner of Syria which is not touched by war. It is a city where people are exhausted by the continuing conflict, where prices are rising, where there's frequent electricity cuts, and where people live with great uncertainty, living, as one person said to me, living from one day to the next in the midst of an unprecedented push to find a way out of this war.
But there's no expectation, despite the gains by the government forces, that Assad is going to be able to take back control of all of Syria at any point, is there?
It was interesting to hear, or a sign of the times, if you want to say, that while on previous visits to Damascus, I would hear how there was a reluctant admission by the government. President Assad himself at one time admitted that he didn't have enough government troops anymore to retain and secure all parts of the country. This time in Damascus, a few months after Russia has intervened militarily, providing all the advanced military hardware to President Assad's forces, I heard government supporters saying to me that they believed they could win. They believe they could take back areas of the north, and including Idlib, for example, which is under the control of a range of opposition groups, including the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Nusra. So they're feeling both in military and political circles in Damascus, there's a new confidence because of the new support, military and political, both from Russia as well as Iran, two key allies of President Assad.
Do you get a sense of how people feel about that Russian intervention and, for that matter, airstrikes coming from the U.S.?
For supporters of the government, and you do meet them in Damascus, you meet them in Homs, you meet them in areas which are under government control, they are absolutely delighted by the Russian intervention. Russia has long been an ally of Syria, going back to many years before the war. The military hardware, including an advanced air defense system, including powerful tanks, including a range of artillery, is helping not just to fight against the so-called Islamic State, which is ostensibly the reason why Russia intervened. It is also helping to bolster President Assad, the position of its forces on some key front lines. So it is welcome by him. And of course, for the opposition, it causes great upset, because this is the kind of support they had hoped the United States and other Western allies would provide to them in their battle to unseat President Assad.
Do they want the U.S. to do more?
for many years now, the opposition has been calling for support, greater support from the United States. As your listeners will know, President Obama has held back, saying that the United States is tired, worn down by the very costly wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. They don't want him to get too involved in a third war. There has been a creeping involvement of the United States with the air campaign, which started last year, last September, targeting not the positions of President Assad, but only of the so-called Islamic State. This was stepped up again recently after the attacks, the terrible attacks in Paris linked to the Islamic State, which caused President Obama to send dozens of military advisors. And it has caused, it has concentrated minds, not just in Washington, but in Paris and Brussels and London and in Arab capitals about how best to fight the growing threats posed by Islamic State, which, of course, are not just in Iraq and Syria and the wider region, but also very much on the minds of people living in the West, but also what to do about President Assad's continuing rule. And that is why that alongside the military intervention, there is also an unprecedented diplomatic push to try to find a negotiated way out of this war.
And then, of course, there is the humanitarian situation. And I want to hear some sound from one of your reports. This is a man, he and his family have had to move three times to escape the war. Let's listen.
It's getting worse. Every day is worse than yesterday. I wish it was last month because that was better.
Lise, what are the living conditions like at this point for that man and his family?
Well, every story in Syria that you hear tells a million stories, millions of stories. Syria has been called by the United Nations for many years the humanitarian test of our time. And when the United Nations announced its annual humanitarian response plan for all of the major crises around the world, Syria took two-fifths of a record sum of money, more than $20 billion being asked by the United Nations to deal with the humanitarian situation in so many places. On the ground, this is a country, try to understand a country where more than half of the population of 22 million is either displaced inside the country, forced to leave their homes by the fighting, has become a refugee outside, or is dead, with a rising death toll, which is now, according to some reliable accounts, more than 250,000 in more than 4 years of war. And when we went to where Abu Mohammed lives, in a shelter in a basement, where they basically depend on water from a bucket, which comes once a week, where there is no reliable electricity, where money is running out. People like Abu Mohammed have moved three times to escape the fighting. So it wouldn't surprise you to learn that in that basement shelter, only about 10 miles from Damascus, half of the people living there have already fled to Europe because they despair they will ever find a life worth living in Syria.
Well, you also spoke with somebody from UNICEF, Razan Rashidi, in that suburb of Kisweh outside of Damascus. Let's listen to Razan Rashidi.
Is tomorrow is going to be a school day or not a school day? It's not clear for the children. Is tomorrow is going to be a hot meal day for a father or a cold meal or no meal day? People are getting really more and more worried about the future, especially because they feel that they don't have any control over their faith.
It's kind of amazing to even think that people are going to school or going to work in the midst of this war zone. But how much of normal life is able to continue?
I don't think you can call any life in Syria normal, because any life is very much bracketed by the war that has gone on and ravaged large parts of Syria. And even when I talk to educated people in Syria whose lives are not as desperate as those displaced people that you heard from, they also say that they simply don't know what's happening from one day to the next. They worry about what is happening one street to the next. They hear the reports from Vienna, from Geneva, from Riyadh, talking about moves to find a political way out of this war. They want to hang on to the hope that somehow this disaster that nobody had expected would last so long and cost so much will someday be over. That's why we have seen over the summer so many Syrians taking that perilous journey to Europe and hoping some of them to reach the United States or Canada as well.
Well, where do you see this going, Lise? Do you see just a generation of Syrians leaving the country? Is there a future for Syria in the borders of Syria that exist today?
I spent a long time this summer going from European country to the next, watching the exodus of Syrians and people from many other countries fleeing war and hardship. And it really was, for Syrians, the flight of the middle class. You meet young engineers, architects, artists. But mostly what struck you was this was the middle class, the professionals who were leaving Syria now, and they are taking with them all of the resources, that the human resources that Syria will need someday to put itself back on its feet after all of the destruction and the damage. It is becoming a country of the very rich and the very poor, and its whole middle class is being stripped away.
That's the BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, just out of a 10-day trip to Syria. Lise, great reporting as always. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.